Small Business and Startup Stories DSM features conversations with small business owners who share both their victories and failures on their path to success. Small Business and Startup Stories DSM is produced by the Greater Des Moines Partnership. More tips and resources are available at dsmpartnership.com/small business. I'm your host, Mike Caldwell.
Matt Ostadick, welcome to Startup Stories. What is Given and how has your journey as an entrepreneur led to starting Given?
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me today. I'm excited to be here. Given is a new platform for connecting people and businesses who are willing to give with nonprofits that need additional help. As you know, my background as an entrepreneur, I've been fortunate to have the chance to start several different companies locally. I started a construction software startup called Submittal Exchange. I started a marketing tech startup called FunnelWise. And I also started an investment and consulting firm called Charette Venture Group. And I've had lots of good experiences, both successes and failures with those, but they've all kind of led me to the point I am today with starting Given, and in particular, wanting to do a startup that has more of a broader community impact as well.
Well, we'll come back to Given a little bit later, but I'd like to back up and ask you what inspired you to start your first company, Submittal Exchange.
Yeah, interesting story. My background and what I actually went to school for as an undergraduate student was architecture. When I was a kid growing up, I always wanted to be an architect. I loved the creation aspect and getting to dream of new buildings and drawings and ideas. Went to school for that, graduated, worked at a local architecture firm. And a couple years after college, I was sitting at my desk working on a process that you have to do in construction and architecture, reviewing what are called shop drawings or submittals, which at the time was a very paper-intensive process for a lot of the documentation that goes back and forth between architects and contractors when a building is in the process of getting built. And today, most of that's electronic. At the time I was involved with that, it was not. And I was thinking to myself, gosh, why don't we have a better way of doing this process? Can't it be more efficient? And they didn't tell me about this in school, that this was going to be part of my job. And that's what led me to creating my first company, Submittal Exchange, that at the time provided a website, a project management system for architects and contractors to use to exchange those types of documents electronically.
And can you give me an idea, what time frame was that? About when did you start that company?
Oh, I don't like to date myself, just like you don't either, right? Progress in years here as well. But I started working on that that idea back in 2003, and really was from 2003 through 2013 was my time with that company.
Well, it was actually a very good time to be doing that. A lot of things happened during that time frame from a technology and capability of implementing software. I remember some of the startups I was involved with in the late 90s and how much more difficult it was, even those 6-7 years before. So when you started Submittal Exchange, I'm curious about if you can take me to just a little bit deeper into the problem that you were solving, because I'm not sure everybody really, I don't really understand all that goes on with an architect as far as those shop drawings and submittals.
Yeah, at a very high level, when people envision what architects do, right, they produce drawings. Blueprints is the historical term, although they have not been actual blueprints for many years, but drawings and today 3D models for what buildings should look like, what the design is for them. That's a big part of an architect's job. But after a contractor's hired and construction starts, particularly on complicated commercial or government projects, there's a lot of documentation that flows back and forth to explain and to verify all the components that are going to go into a building. So everything from the exact type of windows to the ceiling tiles to the carpet under your feet to the rebar in the concrete to the handles and hinges on your doors. I mean, every single thing you see around you in whatever space you're in was documented with what's called a submittal at some point, which is a document that the contractor sends in to the architect to verify that they're going to use the right things on the project. And historically, those things are reviewed and sent in with paper copies. And because there were so many different parties involved with the process, at the time that I started working on this in the early 2000s, you typically get anywhere from 6 to 15 paper copies of each document. And as a young architect, your job was to mark them up because they were never correct. There were always issues with them. And you'd have to hand copy your notes to each of those individual copies with a red pen to make sure that you could see them, because color photocopying at the time was very expensive, cost prohibitive as well. So it was a very painful manual process. Thank goodness Those things are done electronically today, some through the system that I started, but there are many other systems and solutions on the market today, years later as well. But it was very painful and very inefficient and very cost and time consuming at that time.
And personally painful because you were the junior person that got to do the not very fun work of marking all those documents up.
Me and thousands of other young design professionals all across the country doing similar things, yes.
You know, I was involved in a similar company that, not similar in the technology, but in general in the sense of eliminating really, really redundant work and non-value-added work, right? And it's hard to look back now and imagine what it would be like to go back to that. When you think about the productivity improvements we've all gained, when they talk about productivity improvements, you know, what you're talking about is probably thousands of hours on a building, on a good-sized building. So now you were not a software expert at the time, I take it? You didn't have a software background, or did you?
I did not. Again, my background was as an architect. I went to design school for architecture. I was always technology friendly. I like to dabble with website work and other things to learn it, but never as a full-time career occupation. And frankly, I was not particularly business savvy at the time as well. When you go to architecture school, there's so much to learn about buildings that you really don't have time for hardly anything else. When I started my first business, Middle Exchange, I was in the midst of an evening MBA program through Iowa State as well. At the time, my career goal was to be a partner in an architecture firm someday, and I thought an MBA would help me with that. So certainly taking MBA classes helps in some ways. You absolutely do not need an MBA to start a business or be an entrepreneur. In many ways, actually, it may hurt you for that in some ways, but it certainly, in my case, it gave me some comfort level in the language of business, in trying to think critically about business problems and challenges as well. And those were very valuable skills as I turned into a business leader over time. Yeah. Mike, something else I wanted to mention about that very first product, you know, it was interesting, in addition to sending those documents back and forth electronically, architects and contractors have to keep detailed logs of where the documents are and who's approved them when. And the historical way of doing that is in a spreadsheet. And so part of that initial product was to automate the manual spreadsheets that were being kept. And I mentioned that because I think I was listening to one of your other podcasts recently where you were talking with another business owner or a couple of co-founders that were building something that automate things you could do in a spreadsheet. It's amazing how many millions of startups have been created to take things that historically we've done in spreadsheets and have been able to turn into software. And even with that, there's still challenges in the world today that are being done in spreadsheets that probably need automated in software in the future as well.
Well, wasn't it Mitch Kaper that created VisiCalc that started all this off? Because wasn't that the very first spreadsheet, if I remember right? You go back, it's like there was a day when there were no spreadsheets, right? And then we invented the spreadsheet to solve a million problems, which was better than the manual log, if you think about it. At least there was something better about it. But you're absolutely right. I can't imagine how many different businesses I've worked with where the main competition was a spreadsheet from a technical standpoint. That was the solution. And it's grown. It's interesting because now we have something called Airtable out there that portends themselves as the next spreadsheet, right? The tool that is spreadsheet capable, but you can actually create systems with it. I don't want to go off on a tangent, but just the amount of tools you and I have seen come and go, and with the cloud infrastructure that's there today, and now you've got no-code solutions coming to market that are actually quite viable. It's really interesting to think of how much faster someone can get to market now than when they started, when we started. I'm curious, if you look back at Middle Exchange and the experience you had, especially in those early years, what lessons did you take away?
Yeah, I learned thousands of things in those early years, right? As every entrepreneur does. In that journey of trying things and seeing what works and what doesn't as well. I was very fortunate. We were mentioning timing, and I imagine we can talk more about timing in this conversation, but I was fortunate that the timing was right for Middle Exchange. I didn't realize when I was in the middle of it perhaps how lucky I was that the market timing was right for that. That's a huge factor in success or failure of any startup. But you know, the logistics that you go through of trying to build a startup and all the different components that go into it, from creating and managing a product to selling it, marketing it, onboarding customers, supporting them, scaling all of those things in your operations side and the financial side, and bringing on investors, and just all the considerations that you go through. It's a constant game of whack-a-mole when you're running an early stage startup. Like, you get one area going well and the problem pops up in the other one. But you absolutely learn from that over time. I'm not sure if I'm giving a super concise answer to your question here, other than to say it's a lot of fun. It's a tremendous amount of work. Certainly that first experience made me hungry to go do it again and again and again after that as well. But it also is, it can be exhausting at times. You know, it's not, there's a lot you get out of it, but it's not for everybody. Or you have to be careful as you jump into it, what you're committing to it and what you're giving to it as well, if that makes sense.
It does, and no doubt. And so your company was acquired in 2011. And I was just thinking about the fact you went to work for the acquiring company for a couple of years.
So we were acquired by a Chicago company called Textura. And Textura had a larger platform for managing payments on construction projects, which is a whole other issue. How money flows between contractors and subcontractors and project owners. A great platform for doing that. But we joined their team. We were acquired by them in 2011, ran the business as a division of theirs. So to put some context or numbers around it, you know, I grew Submittal Exchange from initially just myself to a small team to, we had about $4 million a year in revenue and about 35, 40 employees at the time we were acquired by Textura. In the 2 years following that, and by the way, we raised a little less than $1 million total in capital that went in to grow that business at the time. In the 2 years following that, Textura put in another $3 or $4 million, which is not a huge amount in today's world, but another $3 or $4 million. We hired an additional 70 people in 2 years, and grew the business from $4 million a year to $10 million a year, just for that division as well. So, you know, the experience of getting to hire, to grow a local office, all these are employees at our office in West Des Moines, hiring 70 people in 2 years, was a great learning experience in and of itself. And trying to figure out how to take what we had that was working and to scale it as rapidly as possible while also integrating with a larger company. Textura was a very ambitious organization. You know, I was a very lightly bootstrapped first-time entrepreneur company. As I said, had raised less than $1 million. Textura was a company with very experienced leaders. They had raised $130 million in investor funding at the time they had acquired us. So they were going after a big problem, and they were very ambitious and aggressive about it. There's challenges with that approach too, but I learned a lot from it. And Textura did a successful IPO on the New York Stock Exchange in the middle of 2013. I had no direct involvement in that process other than to have a front row seat to it as an executive in the organization. And it was fascinating to get to see the inside mechanics of what an IPO process looks like, for better or worse. I did choose to leave there in early that following year because I wanted to jump back into creating and building new things. As luck would have it, and again, timing and luck plays into so much of this, I didn't know this was coming, but I left right before Textura unfortunately got targeted by an aggressive short seller. And a lot of bad news, much of it completely made up, but a lot of bad news came out about the organization and a giant roller coaster ride with their stock price and all sorts of other internal challenges. But Textura was acquired by Oracle Corporation, one of the largest software companies in the world, in 2016, again, after my time there. But I'm pleased that today my former product and some of my former employees still work in Oracle's construction software division today. So it's had a good outcome and a lot of learning from my own experience with it too.
Yeah, I went through a similar situation of being not in the center, but being a part of the team that was a company that was taken public in 88, in 93. So I doubt it was all that much different when you went, but yeah, same kind of thing. You learn a lot from going through that. And if you think startups are complex, going public's complex too. There's no doubt about it. So you left Textura at that point, and you started FunnelWise to solve a problem that you had personally experienced. What was that problem?
Yeah, my next company, FunnelWise, was a marketing technology company, and we were focused on marketing and sales analytics. So one of the challenges I had with scaling Submittal Exchange, even though we were very successful with it, but was really analyzing and utilizing properly the metrics we were getting from a marketing and sales funnel. So all the data points that you collect from what prospects you're engaging with and the activities your sales team is doing and their likelihood or probabilities of closing deals. FunnelWise was a tool, also ironically replacing things that you could do manually in a spreadsheet, but pulling in information from your marketing automation platform and your CRM, Salesforce in our case, and crunching the numbers on it to tell you not just what happened yesterday, but how to turn that into a forward-looking view of what you need to do in the future. So what changes you can make in your business and your marketing and sales operations to grow your revenue even more successfully.
And that is a terribly complex issue to deal with. And you mentioned something, something you wrote about, you kind of had multiple customers because you have sales, you have marketing, and a lot of companies, they work together, but it's kind of a, let's just say that the friendship's not always perfect between sales and marketing. There's a lot of tension between the two groups because they each depend on the other so much. I've got to believe that that had to make it a little harder.
It definitely makes it a challenge. There's a big gulf between marketing and sales in many organizations today, which oftentimes comes down to the personalities involved with both of them. And trying to bridge that gap was interesting because we had a product that frankly helped both marketing and sales. But depending on who we were talking to, you had to change how you explained it to focus more on just one side or the other. And I could share quite a few stories like this, but one example that comes to mind, you know, we had one marketing leader who deployed our tool who was using the software, and we could very clearly show him in the data that the outcome that he was getting from the marketing leads he was generating was tied to how sales was handling the follow-ups. So the timing and the total number of follow-ups that a salesperson was doing with a marketing generated lead had a big impact on whether that lead ultimately converted into an opportunity and a closed one sale over time as well. And this is a marketing leader who's measured on that stuff, like measured on how many of his leads convert. And we could go show, hey, here's the areas where sales needs to change what they're doing with follow-ups. And his answer was, well, sales isn't going to listen to me on that. So I just need you to tell me how many more leads I need to generate instead, because there's nothing I can do there was a credibility and a respect gulf between marketing and sales in that organization, which is not uncommon. So even though the data could show that something needed to be done differently, they actually didn't have the ability to work through it internally to make those changes. So in some ways, even though we were selling software, you oftentimes felt like a little bit like a marriage counselor trying to help with those types of issues, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make perfect sense, because many people will describe companies as either marketing-led or sales-led. And they're very, very different things. And there's an argument for either. And the best case is when they both work well seamlessly together. Doesn't always happen that way. So you wrote an excellent post on LinkedIn about your experience at FunnelWise. In the end, you had to make the difficult decision to wind down the business. In your post, you refer to market timing as a key issue. Can you expand on that idea?
Yeah, fundamentally, and I didn't always appreciate this well enough as a younger entrepreneur. It took some years of experience to learn this. But in my opinion, there's three major things that impact any startup success. You know, number one is the vision and strategy for what that company is trying to do. Number two is the execution on it, how well they actually go out and execute on that strategy and then evolve their execution over time. But number three is absolutely market timing. And again, I didn't appreciate that early enough. Even with Submittal Exchange, we hit the exact right market timing on that in hindsight. But I thought from that experience, because we were so successful, that market timing was something that you could will into existence if you tried hard enough at the other things. And we certainly tried that. With FunnelWise, I was much more aggressive than I was with Submittal Exchange. As I mentioned, we raised a small amount of capital. I was a first-time entrepreneur with Submittal Exchange. And it worked out well. But in hindsight, when I reflected back on it, I said, gosh, if I'd had more capital, if I poured a little more fuel or gas on the fire more quickly, we could have been even more successful. You know, we could have doubled the return we did for our investors, even though we generated a fantastic return for everybody that was involved. And then I saw the example of the company that acquired us that was much more aggressive in their capital raising and growth plans too. So I learned from that. And with FunnelWise, I was much more aggressive. I put a lot of personal capital into it. I brought on investors because I had a track record then as an entrepreneur. We were much more aggressive and ambitious about it. And we found ultimately that we, even despite that, even despite you know, working our tails off to execute as hard as we possibly could over several years, we just didn't have the right market timing on it. In many ways, in that particular space, you know, we were providing this great tool that solved a problem using a company's marketing and sales data. But we found a lot of the market actually didn't have good enough sales and marketing data to use that type of tool yet, because they were still stuck in the early ages of trying to figure out how to even implement Salesforce or other CRMs, or teaching their people how to use it. And we were just a little too far ahead of where the market was. We ended up focusing on selling to startups, because startups tended to be, other startups, particularly on the coast, tended to be more mature with their use of those systems. But then we found that wasn't a large enough market for us to scale in. And frankly, we were probably in the wrong location to be in Iowa and just focusing on selling to coastal startups for the most part as well. So market timing, the trick with market timing is it's really hard. I'd be curious for your thoughts on this. I'd say almost impossible to know for sure if you've got the right timing until you start trying it. You can look at all the factors and analyze it, but until you get out there and build something and start executing with it and seeing how it's received, you oftentimes don't know if that you've got that timing right or not. So you almost have to jump in and see what happens while taking the right amount of risk without too much to really assess whether you've got the timing right.
You're absolutely right. And it's part of, you know, when we were much younger, you and I, the number one reason startups failed was they ran out of money. Mm-hmm. Today, it's product market fit. And one of the things people don't think about when they consider product market fit is market timing. And so when you think about market timing and look at Netflix as an example of market timing, they knew the timing was wrong due to technology. So they started with physically mailing DVDs to people and then converted them over time. And I think that you're right, you can't call the timing, but I think there have been some companies that were fairly thoughtful about building the technology that could be adopted today, even though it's not what they wanted to build. We have to build what can exist in the system today and then move them to where we want them to be. And I think Oracle did a lot of that over the years. I think SAP did a lot of that over the years. Or the other option you have on market timing is to vertically integrate. And while it's not a software company, I've been reading a lot about what's going on in the auto industry. Because I grew up in the auto industry. My brother is a Ford dealer. My father used to run a Chevrolet store. And it's interesting that what Elon Musk is doing in the auto industry right now is basically what Henry Ford did. He's vertically integrating. He's buying nickel straight from mines. He's building his own battery plants. He can change the market timing by providing all of his own inputs, or as many of his own inputs as he possibly can. The amount of money that takes is astronomical. So when you talk about raising capital, those are very serious capital raises.
I was thinking, you were saying that, yes, most of us unfortunately aren't Elon Musk in terms of our ability to get investors to pour capital in, right? Because to really take the long view, to go after the biggest challenges like he is, you've got to have the funding to support that as well.
And there was just a couple of years ago when people were writing him off when he was sleeping in his office trying to learn how to build a car. And I remember my brother saying, they can build a few, but building a few hundred thousand is a whole other game. And he came out and said, we over-automated. They pulled a lot of automation and went back to humans to build those cars. And something he did not want to do, but he learned a lesson. So I got one more question for you, just relating back to FunnelWise. You know, we're in the middle of COVID-19, which is why those listening can hear the sound quality is not what we would like it to be today. We have many companies here in Des Moines and across the country and world dealing with the difficult decision of winding down a business. And while it absolutely pains me to my very soul to even have to talk about this, I'm curious. You've been through this. I have to a lesser extent. But what advice can you offer to those facing that decision of, do I wind down?
It's not an easy decision. I mean, it's a terrible decision. One of the, there's other things in life that are harder, but certainly in business, it's one of the hardest things you could possibly face. The emotion that it evokes in me as an entrepreneur and did at the time, and frankly, even still does today, reflecting back on it, is just wanting to walk over to the corner of the room and puke your guts out. Like, that's what it feels like to have to think through those things, for better or worse, unfortunately. I think there are certain financial realities that you have to deal with, though, and that's true of any business. Businesses can't run just on goodwill alone. It'd be great if they could, but ultimately, at some point, you have to be able to pay the people that work with you and pay suppliers and have customers pay you and those other considerations that it takes. And so every business is different, but evaluating when you're to that point that those finances just don't work for you anymore. And that's what happened with FunnelWise. We ran out of capital. We spent a year trying to raise additional money, even though we had raised quite a bit before, but we realized that the timing was going to take longer than we thought. The challenge was going to be more expensive than we thought. We solved many of the issues and actually had made a pivot with our product that I think would have been very successful, but required more capital to maintain. And then due to a variety of circumstances, we weren't able to raise that additional money. Ultimately, at the end of the day, that's the CEO's fault. In that case, it's my fault. But that's what caused our demise. But in any business, as you deal with the pandemic today and other challenges, you have to really stay in tune with those financial challenges and think through what that looks like moving forward. If anyone's listening to this and you're in that situation, the one additional piece of advice I can offer is if you have to make the decision to wind down, do it in a way that treats everyone else who's a stakeholder in it right. You've got to be respectful and communicate with them and be professional about that. There's nothing that I could wish stronger other than that we'd had a different outcome with FunnelWise. But I am happy is a strong word, but I'm glad we at least took the steps to be, I'm not happy about the outcome, but I'm happy that we at least took the steps necessary to try and do it respectfully to everyone else who had a stake in it. What I mean by that is we gave every one of our employees enough notice that every person that worked for us had a job offer from another company before they got their last paycheck from FunnelWise. That's telling people in advance versus, you know, waiting till after you literally run out of money in the bank and there is no more time. And we also took the time to share the bad news with our investors and to communicate with them about it and to answer questions. Nobody was happy about it. That's the worst conversation you have to have with an investor. But being upfront about it versus running away from it or disappearing, like you have to think about how to treat everybody who's involved with your venture correctly on it, to do it the right way if you're in that situation.
Yeah. Well, on to a different topic. I'm really interested to hear more about your latest startup, Given. Tell me more about what it's doing, specifically the problem you're solving. You talked about nonprofits, businesses, giving. That's been around for as long as people have been around with some ability to barter or trade. What is it you're solving here?
Yeah, I would say there's two, to answer even a little more broadly, I'd say there's two driving factors with Given, why I chose to create it and why we're building it today. So one is to help connect individuals and businesses that are willing to give with nonprofits that have additional needs. And it's that connection ability of trying to build new connections to help you as a donor or as a business owner who's willing to give back. And frankly, most people in the U.S. do give to one or more nonprofits each year. And most people who give say, when you ask them, would you be willing to do additional giving if you were presented with a need that really aligned with your interests and values? People overwhelmingly say yes to that. But how can we use technology to better build those connections to really take the needs that are out there, most of which most of us haven't even heard of because we don't oftentimes have the time to go investigate and research every nonprofit that's out there? How do we connect those things with the people and businesses that are willing to give? That's what Given is trying to do from a platform standpoint. And I think about the way that It's always challenging when any app compares themselves to Uber, right? And not that we're Uber specifically, but that concept of matching in a marketplace where Uber matches people that need a ride with people that are driving a car around. We're trying to do the same thing in the nonprofit space with matching people and businesses that are willing to give with nonprofits that have additional needs. I started working on Given 2 years ago after reflection on what I wanted to build next. And, you know, I can come up with a list of 20 additional things I'd like to build that would be cool and would hopefully make money, right? But I felt called to do something that would have more of an impact, that would really help not just my customers, but help people and organizations in need. And that's what led me down the path of building Given. And that was before COVID hit. And just as we talk about all the businesses that have challenges with COVID, the nonprofit space is very, very difficult right now. And the communities and audiences they serve, the more we can do to help them today and over the next several years, the better, quite frankly, because the needs are profound. I know I'm editorializing a little bit here, but the other comment I wanted to make was another driving factor for me on this is reflection on what the startup ecosystem looks like, both in Des Moines, but nationwide as well. You know, in startup world, and startup conferences and podcasts and everything else, we spend a tremendous amount of time talking about the what and how of what people are doing, what they're building, how they're going about it, the practical advice on how to be more successful with that. we don't spend enough time talking about why. Why do we build startups? What are the driving factors with all of that? You know, when you look at a national scale, a lot of the driving factors come down to having the opportunity to make a lot of money with a big exit that everybody dreams about. And most startups never achieve that, but everybody dreams about that. That's a factor. And also a desire to build cool products with innovative technology, to do something new and different. Those are big factors in driving the creation of startups. But I don't think we spend enough time talking about societal impact and how startups actually do or don't help the communities around them beyond just their investors and their customer bases as well. And to give one last example on this, then I'll stop talking, but there's a conference I'm a fan of, or an organization, SASTR, right? Software as a service is the term for those that aren't familiar with it. Jason Lumpkin is a successful startup founder multiple times, a VC today, and SASTR is his VC fund that has a conference, SASTR, the SASTR Annual. That's like the go-to event in San Francisco every year for talking about companies and founders building things that are software as a service. If you look at what they talk about in a conference like that, last year's event, 100 plus sessions talking about how to build successful startups and SaaS startups in particular. Out of 100 sessions, they had 2 sessions on ethics. And one of those sessions, the definition of ethics when building a startup was don't go to jail. Like, that's the definition of being ethical when you're building a startup. And it's like, are you kidding me? That's the bar that we're held to in the startup space is, well, as long as I'm not hurting other people, or maybe if I am hurting other people, as long as I don't get arrested or don't get caught and don't go to jail, that's considered ethical when it comes to the startup space. That's just such complete BS, in my honest opinion. There's a lack of a conversation happening in the startup world about societal impact in a time when we desperately need more of that. And as a follow-up, this year's SASTR annual event was held completely online, 30 sessions, so we reduced footprint based on the online presence. Great conference still. No sessions about ethics as well. Just an absence of conversation about that at a time when we desperately need it. So part of what I'm doing with Given is to build a platform to help these specific nonprofits in Des Moines and nationwide. But part of it is just a desire on my part to help spur more conversation in the startup ecosystem about how we can all use our incredible talents to build things that really matter and really make a difference for our broader society as a whole.
You know, I can relate to that because when I reflect on my first career, which was in the mobile computing space, and I was involved in mobile computing, as you know, pretty much from the beginning, starting in 1984. When I look back, one of the biggest impacts we had was putting people out of work. And that doesn't feel good to say that, but at the end of the day, we took what was an incredibly inefficient world of manual distribution and manual accounting and automated it. And we made a lot of companies a lot of money. But on the downside, we put a lot of people out of work. And that's hard to deal with. And so as you age and go through that experience of having something like that happen, and we weren't unethical. We knew what we were doing. Everybody knew what we were doing. The unions didn't like it, but they understood. You do want to do something different that means more. I look at a lot of the people who have had successful startups, and one of the things in general they do is go fund more successful startups. So the good news, I think, along your line is we as investors, and I believe you do some investing, and I know I'm an angel investor. We try to invest in things that actually have a positive benefit, not just make money. Yeah, I'd like to make money. I'm going to admit it. I don't mind making more money. But I really want to make a positive impact. And that's what I think it's interesting what you're trying to do with Given. Now, this podcast is not going to air until after your launch event coming up. So if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about what you're going to announce at that launch that, again, will not be out and will have already taken place by the time we come up.
Yeah, so Given, I launched an MVP of it, a minimum viable product, last year. And we relaunched it this year. I'm very pleased that it's grown beyond just a one-person team working on it. So we've got a group of about 25 people across 4 time zones that are all active on the Given team and contributing and building our technology, building our marketing, reaching out to nonprofits, talking to businesses. Tremendous amount of work happening on it. As we record this, and also when this goes live and our audience is able to listen to this, the Given app is available in the App Store and on our website at givenapp.com. We do have an upcoming launch event at the time that we're recording this, we're talking specifically with the Des Moines community. So in Des Moines, which we've started with as our home base, even though the given team is spread across the entire country, we've spent the past few months onboarding local nonprofits with it and helping them provide their information, but also provide details about specific things they need help with, funding needs, and collecting not just numbers and text descriptions, but also visuals and information to really help donors understand what they can contribute to build those connections. We've also been very pleased to have a great partnership with the Community Foundation of Greater Des Moines, a terrific organization that just does such tremendous work in helping to support the local nonprofit landscape as well. And in a couple weeks here, or actually next week, as of the time we're recording this, our launch event will be talking more about all the great organizations, nonprofit-wise, that have come on in the Des Moines area and what's available to local businesses to participate in this platform to help support those organizations and their particular needs.
So this is really extending on something that started at the foundation. I used to serve on a committee over there, and they had, through a DSM Hack event, put together, you know, a real simple website to match donors with small needs and specific projects. This sounds like the natural extension to that very early alpha. I'd call it an alpha, not even a beta, trial of what the Community Foundation was trying to create.
That's absolutely correct. And givedsm.org is the website you're referring to, which is that website that was initially built at a DSM hack that lists local nonprofit needs. It is very synergistic with what Given is doing. And as part of our partnership with the Community Foundation, a new version of GiveDSM will be launching in the next several weeks as well. That new version is built on the Given platform. So it using the technology that we built for Given will also be fueling GiveDSM for the Community Foundation. And we have aspirations to take that same model and share it with other community foundations in other cities across the country in the future as well.
That makes perfect sense. You mentioned, and I want to go back to this, that you've got 25 people working across four time zones. Did you do that before COVID started, or was this a post-COVID, I had to do it?
Yeah, interesting question. It was not a response to COVID. It would just happen to coincide with it from a timing standpoint,
okay. Regardless.
Yeah. So I had launched an MVP of this last year and had gotten test users and a pilot program with a half dozen local businesses and local nonprofits using it to prove that the technology would work and would create value for all of the participants in it. Earlier this year, I started looking for people to help with it. And I put out a call on my personal LinkedIn network asking, would anybody be willing to help build this startup as a part-time virtual side project, was what I was initially looking for. Thinking that it was still early stage enough that we weren't ready to bring on full-time employees, but we needed additional help from many other people. And I wasn't sure what to expect. Honestly, I was thinking, you know, if two or three people respond to this, that would be success, right? I had 30 plus responses to that LinkedIn message. I've also reached out to and connected with a lot of other folks across the country that are interested in contributing to this and have built a terrific team with it. Are the hours that each of our team members contribute vary depending on, some of them are full-time employed elsewhere, some are not, but they're all working on this as their time allows to contribute to it. For me, it's been a great lesson in the power of building something that has real purpose as well. You know, certainly there's a million startups trying to say, hey, come work for us and help build something that will make money. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's terrific. But building something where I can also talk to people about how it's a business that hopefully will make money someday in the future and use that money then to fuel the good that we're doing in the world. But also, even in the short term, while it's small, we can see the specific impact it's having on the nonprofits we're assisting. That's really, really powerful for people to want to contribute to something like this.
So looking out, as we wrap this up, you mentioned, you know, looking farther out at the different community foundations. There's much more to the nonprofit world than that. How do you see Given growing, and what do you see it as the long-term, I don't know, aspiration of the company? What would you aspire to see Given become?
Our aspiration is to be a national and someday an international platform for building those connections between people that are willing to give and organizations that have additional needs. So there's a lot of growth yet to come to achieve that, but that's certainly where we're headed with this as well. There's so many different organizations that could use help And again, with the timing with COVID and the economy and all the other things that we see on the news this year, there's just such a tremendous opportunity to provide that help over time in the years to come as well. So we have big growth plans. We're very proud to start here in Des Moines, to be working with the local community, to be working with the Community Foundation and others, but we have big aspirations on a national and international level as well.
You earlier compared yourself loosely to Uber in the sense of matching. To me, it's a combination of eBay and Kickstarter when I think about it. And I eBay used to be a little bitty company instead of Kickstarter at the very beginning. So I can see you getting there as well. The need is definitely there. And I think that what you're creating will truly expand the giving market. Matt, I want to thank you very much for being on Startup Stories. I really appreciate the time talking to you today.
Mike, I appreciate the invitation, and I've commented to you before. I love what you do with the podcast, the years you put into this, the many incredible guests you've had over the years, and just the knowledge that you share and facilitate sharing with our Des Moines community. We're so fortunate to have this and the work you do for us. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Small Business and Startup Stories DSM podcast. Inspired by these stories, we offer a hub full of resources needed for any small business owner to grow and succeed in Greater Des Moines, Iowa at dsmpartnership.com/smallbusiness. Thanks for listening.